As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel. Joined, as always, by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, you had a interesting vantage point for the return of the Big Ten and all the other action on Saturday.
I did. It was a long but entertaining day for me. I got to our studios at 5 a.m. To get ready for our big noon kickoff show. And then, because those guys were on the road, I was with Emmanuel Acho and Mike Hill in studio. And so I was at the desk pretty much from, basically like 11 or noon Pacific till 8 at night, and or 8 Pacific, which is obviously 11 at night Eastern. And, you know, at one point we were sitting there, we were just like, because the Penn State Indiana game, which really felt like the game of the day because of everything that happened in the last hour of it, and it was an FS1 game, and that was one of the games that was kind of, we had to be, you know, handling post game and halftime for. So it was on big on your radar, and just to kind of watch it unfold, there was just so much drama and so much craziness in that game. Then once that game ended, I think we had to pivot to Boise State, Utah State, and you're feeling like, I mean, I know this is way inside the weeds of this show, but like, you know, 2 days before, I'm getting way up to speed on those two programs, and I have all this stuff on Bodie Reeder's the offensive coordinator at Utah State, and Jeff Schmetting's the defensive coordinator at Boise State. And they used to coach together at Eastern Washington, and all this stuff from talking to both guys on Friday about their teams. And I'm like, oh, I got all this stuff ready to go. And then as you're watching the, you know, this, you know, amazing drama in the Big Ten fold, you're like, yeah, that stuff's going to go right out the window right now because something much bigger and on the front burner is happening. And, you know, I was glad, you know, I was watching on social media as people were really just kind of getting connected to that game and kind of found it, just because, look, I mean, we've talked about Tom Allen some on the show, and I always feel like his guys just always play their butts off for him. And, you know, Michael Penix played really well down the stretch, and there was some head scratching moments. And let's start with that game before we get all the way in, because it was a huge day for the Big Ten to come back. But at what point did you kind of get sucked into Penn State, Indiana?
Oh, geez. Sometime in the second half. And the whole time I kept thinking, I remember it was 17-7 Indiana when I started really focusing in. And Kate Hieropoulos, one of our editors, IU grad, Brody Miller, our LSU writer, IU grad. Still follow them very closely, and I'm slacking Kate, like, your Hoosiers, here they come. But how many times have you watched an Indiana football game over the years against an Ohio State, a Michigan, a Penn State, and they tease you for like 3.5 quarters, and then they don't pull it off? And it sure seemed like that was what was going to happen. Basically, when Indiana had that weird squib kick and just handed them the ball at the 50 at the end, I'm like, oh, geez. This is the most Indiana football thing ever. But they did win. They won in very controversial fashion. And this is what college football is all about to me. The wild emotional swings off of not just one game, but one play. I mean, that you know, whatever we want to say, the inch or 2 inches or whatever it was that he may or may not have, you know, converted that 2-point conversion on, just like wildly changes everybody's feelings about Penn State and about James Franklin and are they going to be 0-2? And I don't think anybody, even the officials, could tell you definitively one way or the other whether he was in or not.
Right. And I think just because of how it was ruled on the field, it's just really hard to overturn that. Now, I did think they might overturn it. You know, we were talking about this on the set and Mike Hill had pointed out, he's like, look, the ball is touching, looks like it's touching the sideline before it, like at first it's like the ball goes down before and just barely kind of bounces up or kind of leans up after it hits the ground. But again, I think it's just really hard for them to overturn something and say conclusively what that was. You know, like to me, there were so many moments in that game. Obviously, one of the ones that stands out was Devin Ford getting to like the 1 yard line and realizing, wait, this is too easy. I'm being trapped. I'm being duped. I gotta stop. And it was too late. He was in. And then, you know, we had this discussion off camera. We're like, you know, Acho makes the point, you should go for 2 then, because then you can put the game out of reach, even though, you know, I think, you know, look, coaches are almost paid to be second guessed. And I think no matter what you do, you probably run the risk of going in the wrong direction. But his feeling was, I don't care what the analytics say, because of momentum, if they score a touchdown on the last minute, they're going to get the 2. Like, he's convinced that momentum is going to, like, you're going to be reeling. It's college kids. And I can't say I disagree with him, because that's how it felt when Penix made that, you know, run to get into the end zone. Like, a guy just misses him and he just finds a way in.
I mean, all I know is the and hundreds of responses I think I got. There was a fantastic picture that photographer
from the Center
Daily Times took. And half the people said, see, that's definitive proof he was out. And half the people said, that's definitive proof that he's in. So when that's the case, I think it's pretty clear that they couldn't overturn the call on the field. And I do wonder if it's a split second decision, who knows? But if you're the official, I would think you'd rather err on the side of it's in and let the replay overturn it than to err on the side of, you know, denying them the chance to win the game. Like, the game would be over and because they wouldn't have the proof to overturn it.
Yeah, I think the question, you know, look, going back to, do you, because I think James Franklin in the postgame said that his players were instructed, hey, you know, don't score a touchdown in that case. I mean, do you just kneel on it 3 times with whatever, I think it was a minute and 45 or a minute and 46 left. And do you just take your chances at that point as opposed to risk a fumbled exchange or anything else that could have happened? Is it a different story? And obviously that's hindsight, but, you know, just, it was a great way to have the Big Ten back. I know if you're a Penn State fan, you just certainly don't think that, because now you're 0-1 and you got Ohio State next.
James Franklin, for whatever reason, is somebody who fans of other teams are just like desperate to get us to acknowledge that he's overrated. And Penn State fans can't stand his game management. And I think that was such an unusual situation. I can't blame Devin Ford for following his, you know, the instinct of any college football player that you have a chance to score a touchdown, you score a touchdown. And I would say that I would actually, I don't know why this one didn't get mentioned, but when they kicked that 57 yard field goal, there were still 8 seconds left. He didn't think he could run one more play and try to
sideline out. That's what we thought was going to happen. Maybe you, and the thing was, that was a 57 yard field goal. If that was from 55, they win the game.
He made it. Yeah. Yeah. He clearly had faith in his kicker and he almost did make it. They had a lot of chances to win the game. And also the final score obscures the fact that Penn State's defense, before Indiana drove down the field at the very end, I think they were at like 144 yards of offense for the whole game. So you've got a defense that played very well. You had any number of chances to win the game, but they didn't. And now it's like the sky is falling. I will say that it was not a good, if you were a Penn State fan who was worried going into the season about the receivers, this game certainly did not answer those questions at all. And I mean, I think Journey Brown.
And when you say receivers qualified and say, you mean wide receivers, not Pat Freiermuth, the tight end.
Right. Wide receivers outside of Dotson, who was like the only semi-proven guy coming into it. And he was the only guy that made any plays. And obviously, I mean, they lost Journey Brown possibly for the season. That was announced this week. Noah Cain goes out on the first series, and suddenly that four-headed backfield they had last year was down to one.
Yeah, I mean, and that's everything right there. Like, right, because there was a couple of throws that Sean Clifford just missed on that turned into picks. And again, I mean, you don't want to write anybody off after 1 week, and I'm not suggesting to do that. The one thing I thought about, and I heard this on our Big Noon show. I know Urban seemed to say it very adamantly that Penn State was, after Ohio State, the second best team in the Big Ten. Now that we're sitting here 24 hours or less than 24 hours after the first day, I don't know how you didn't watch what happened in Minnesota last night and think Michigan is a lot more dangerous team than Penn State. Joe Milton backed up all the hype I was hearing from the people who are inside that program. He is very talented, and he feels like a difference maker. Now, I'm not saying he's going to have the year Justin Fields had last year, but he is a big arm, physical runner, and he seems to fit in that offense. They have a lot of speed. And the thing that also stood out to me was they have a really, really nasty defensive line. And you saw that. I mean, that was a pretty good team. They whipped last night on the road. So I'm going to ask you this. Here's an opportunity. We both kind of probably awed or were kind of really wowed by Graham Mertz's accuracy on Friday night with the Wisconsin passing game. Right now on Sunday morning, the second best team in and the biggest threat to Ohio State is...
You want me to say Michigan?
I don't know why you wouldn't at this point, but please tell me.
Well, based off one game, you would. But I mean, look, we always wildly overreact to week one.
Yes, and I'm doing it now, right?
I think it's even more extreme this year because we waited so long to see them play week one. And obviously, it's kind of like LSU Mississippi State, right? Like, you just don't know until a couple weeks later. Like, maybe Minnesota is much worse this year than they were last year, especially on defense. You just don't know. But there's no question that was a great showing by their offense, and they looked explosive, which is not something I've said often about Michigan under Jim Harbaugh. The only reason I'm hesitating is Wisconsin is always a threat in the Big Ten, and they have a quarterback now, which is, you know, something I haven't said since Russell Wilson. We'd been hearing about Graham Mertz for 2 years since he was probably a junior in high school. And all he did in his first, it reminded me of, I'm not saying he's Jameis Winston. I don't want to make it clear, but
whoa, where's this going?
This is going, do you remember Jameis Winston's first
the Pitt game?
Yeah. Okay. Where he, I think, almost didn't, it was very similar where, I mean, Graham Mertz had one incompletion the other night. That's all I'm saying is like very similar circumstances where you've been hearing about the guy, he's going to be the savior quarterback, and he comes out in the first game and could not have a better game. Now, it could be that the year they finally have a quarterback is the first year in the history of recent Wisconsin football they don't have great running backs. They certainly weren't impressive the other night. But, you know, that to me is a game changer. So I'd like to hold off at least a week before making any grand declarations. And, of course, with Michigan, you don't want to get sucked in yet again, and then it gets to the end of the year and they get housed by Ohio State again. But yes, one game, if you're doing Big Ten power rankings after one game, I'm pretty sure you'd have Ohio State 1, Michigan 2, and Wisconsin 3.
If you're a betting man, and after the last few weeks, evidently you are, because I hear you're hanging out at the OTB and you're betting games every chance you get.
I did my first ever third quarter bet last night and won.
Yeah. So since you're a betting man, who do you think right now, if you had to bet on one team being having the best chance to win the Big Ten that's not Ohio State, who would you bet?
Isn't that the same question?
It is, but I'm trying to get you to answer it.
Well, it's not really the same question because you have to think about the divisions there.
Come on, please.
I can't answer that.
Oh,
yet.
Come
you're,
on. What
the? You're ready to go ahead and declare somebody the best threat? It's a
podcast. It's not, yeah. It's not a blood oath. What are you doing?
I'll just be conservative like this program and say Wisconsin.
Fair enough. That's all I was asking. Thank you.
Okay. It's a safe bet. Although they've got some new threats in their division. Did you pay attention to a couple of the Big Ten West teams?
I did. By the way, one of the more impressive wins, the team that I thought was going to come out of the West, and look, they still might, but was Iowa and Purdue without its head coach, Jeff Rom, and without its best player, Rondale Moore, still won the game. So hats off to the Boilers.
That was a good win for them. On the podcast last week, first of all credit to Dave Revson. He told us about Indiana. He made that statement and they go out and deliver. But I heard you say that about Iowa and I was thinking, do you know, they lost a whole bunch of key guys from last year, most notably their star defensive lineman. I'm not saying they're going to stink. But I was a little surprised you were willing to go ahead and pick them to win the division.
I just, you know, some of that, Stu, has to do with that they, there's nobody I look at. Look, I was impressed with Graham Mertz, but the concern I have is this program's whole DNA is built on being able to run the football really, really well. And Jonathan Taylor, and certainly, you know, years back, Melvin Gordon, they gave them really big plays in the run game. I'm still, like, not very sure on that. Remember, like, Illinois is okay, but Illinois also had like their best defensive player knocked out of their game. You know, like they were missing a couple of really good linebackers. Again, I'm not saying it meant nothing, but I guess I'm still skeptical on Wisconsin being a legit top 10 team this year. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll be proven wrong. But when I look at the West, I think the West is totally, totally up for grabs. And so, you know, we've talked in the, I think last week or a couple of weeks ago about Nebraska's schedule, and I could see Nebraska being better than they were last year, but not having much to show for it record-wise. You know, Minnesota, you know, even with Tanner Morgan and Rashad Bateman back, you know, I think, as you alluded to, I mean, they lost Antoine Winfield, they lost some really good defensive players, and so that's why I was looking at Iowa. I think Iowa has really good skill talent, you know, in terms of speed at receiver and speed in the backfield. And I'd heard really good things about Spencer Petras, the new quarterback, and the offensive line should be really good. I mean, they replaced a first round pick with another guy who should be a top 100 pick. So, again, the thing that I could not, and I don't know where to factor this in, is they've had a really tumultuous offseason, but I was kind of banking on Kirk Ferentz, and again, that still may work out, but I don't know how much to take away from that other than I thought it was a really, really strong win for Purdue considering what they didn't have in that game.
I know you got caught up watching the Dodgers in the World Series last night, so you must have, because you must have missed a pretty important development because you just spent all this time talking about the Big Ten West, and you didn't even mention the most impressive team in the Big Ten West last
night. Reference off of this? You sent me a text at I don't know what time, and this was one of the games that was on my on our screens. It was, I had watched the first quarter and saw Talia, Tua's brother, throw two picks in the first quarter, and they did not look good. Maryland was getting whipped by your alma mater. And you know, it was like, I wasn't locked in that game, but I knew it was like 20-3 at one point or whatever. And you sent a text about Mick McCall and I'm sitting there thinking did I miss something that happened at Iowa State or something? I thought it was an Iowa State related thing. And instead you were with glee where you feel like it's like you got the Eric Coryell, Dan Fouts Chargers now wearing purple or something.
It was a running thing on the podcast last year where I kept talking about how it was just, I mean, Northwestern had one of the worst offenses in the recent history of Big Ten football last year. And, you know, Northwestern fans have been calling for him to fire Mick McCall for like 5 years. And you kept defending his honor. And I was like, what?
I don't know
what, for what?
Defending his honor. Did I?
Now, look, props to Mick McCall. First of all, you've mentioned I had completely forgotten that he was the running backs coach at Iowa State now, which means he's coaching the number one running back in the country, Breece Hall. So this worked out for everybody. He's got a new gig. And meanwhile, I mean, night and day. I mean, just like, you know, we've talked about a lot of teams where you hear about something, you hear the buzz over the offseason, but you got to see it to believe it. I mean, Peyton Ramsey and the new OC, Mike Bajakian, I mean, they that was their most lopsided Big Ten win in 50 years, and they just looked competent on offense. After last year, that was a big change. So you got to temper it. It's Maryland. Maryland is probably terrible, but encouraging start for them. And I can't believe we've talked about the Big Ten for, what, 20 minutes already? And not yet given a shout out to the Rutgers Scarlet Knights.
They look great. I mean, you know, as look, I think this is a situation where you had a Michigan State program that has been backsliding towards the end of Mark D'Antonio, and then you have a coaching staff take over at the latest possible moment, and they did not look good at all. But the thing that jumped out at me was that was the fastest and most focused and different energy about Rutgers that we've seen in years, right? And this is, I had a stat at one point. They had forced half as many turnovers in like a half a game yesterday as they did all of last year in 12 games. And they were getting after it. And again, I'm not predicting that they're going to go win six or seven games in a shortened schedule, but they look like they're going to be pretty formidable, you know, and Shiano, he has, you know, he added some really, you know, decent or capable transfers, mostly from FBS programs. And Noah Vedral looked really good in the offense. He's very decisive and he had a commanding presence. And obviously, you know, that was hats off to him because he was a guy who started his career with Scott Frost at UCF, then went to Nebraska. And now he's getting his chance with the Scarlet Knights. I you know, it's like, I really think, and maybe this is a jumping off point here, but like I think a lot of people outside of maybe the metropolitan area have no idea how good of a job Greg Schiano did at Rutgers the first time, because they don't know how awful Rutgers was and what a punchline it was. And he got them to be at one point a legit top 25 program. And then all of a sudden, that shitstorm with Tennessee happened, and it just becomes a circus. And I don't know. If I'm a Rutgers fan, I'm probably feeling really good how it played out. I'm sure Tennessee fans are. Greg Schiano could win Coach of the Year honors in the Big Ten, and Jeremy Pruitt could go whatever 3-7 this year, and I still think Rutgers or Tennessee fans still would think. Be happy with the way it worked out, but you know.
Yeah, actually, if you want some confirmation of that, Joe Rexford did a really story on Friday talking to some of the, putting some the personalities and the real life behind some of the more active members of Vol Twitter, right? People who you know, it's this whole community of Tennessee fans. And so he did like a mini profile of each of them with the same questions. And one thing that stood out to me is that they all wear it as a badge of pride, how they ran Greg Schiano off. And I'm thinking, I mean, how are you so sure that you made the right, that in the end they made the right hire? And of course, Alabama blew out Tennessee. That's not unexpected, but there's a pretty remarkable stat going around that and he's now been there 30 games, Jeremy Pruitt. And he's had twice as many losses of 21 points or more than Butch Jones and Derek Dooley combined. So, I mean, I know they were all excited after the Gator Bowl win and the great recruiting class, but you know, they're 2-3 and the momentum has. I think at the end of the day, Greg Schiano ended up where he should be. I mean, he's a New Jersey guy and that's the right job for him. But I still think that whole thing was inexcusable. They ruined his reputation over a completely false accusation. And he does still know how to coach. And by the way, you said you don't – people have – I mean, it was almost 20 years ago now that Greg Schiano started his first tenure at Rutgers, but this is how bad they were. In his first year, they lost 61-0 to Miami, 50-0 to Virginia Tech, 30-5 to Temple.
What was the West Virginia score?
And that was the one I was going to get to. 80-7. 80-7 to a West Virginia team that, if I'm not mistaken, that year went 3-8. So that was Rich Rod's first year there. So, I mean, as bad as Rutgers has been recently in the Big Ten, I think they were even worse when he took over the first
time. Oh, they were. I mean, they were a grease spot in college football at that point. And I just remember, I don't know, maybe it was 3 or 4 years in, but it, like I used to live in New York and I knew Schiano when he was the defensive coordinator at Miami and I got to know him pretty well. And so I went over to Rutgers a few times when he first got there and knew how bleak it was. And so knowing all that, I remembered they were in, I think it was called the Insight Bowl at that point.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
And I'll tell you when I realized, I was like, holy bleep, Rutgers has actually made it, because at the beginning of the game, Brent Musburger was doing their bowl game. I was like, oh my God, Brent Musburger is doing a Rutgers bowl game. Whoever would have imagined this a few years ago? And so, look, I mean, you know, I just knowing what a absolute, you know, circus and how ridiculous some of that stuff was that came from the Tennessee fallout, you know, props to him, because it's like that couldn't have been easy when you're, you know, your family's dealing with it and everything else. And it's, you know, it's again, and that has nothing to do with Jeremy Pruitt, to be honest. I mean, that's more of, that was a fan base right. thing and a fraction of the fan base, but look, I don't know what Rutgers will do from here, but if you're a Scarlet Knight fan, I mean, he was the only guy that they really wanted and they get it. And now they got him and, you know, you couldn't have asked for a better start than what they got.
By the way, real quick, do you remember this moment from the Greg Schiano first era? So that was the 2001 season we were just talking about. The next year they play Miami in, New Brunswick, and, they're playing Miami, defending national champion Miami, Willis McGahee, Ken Dorsey, and Rutgers was winning the game at halftime. And I just remember, I can't remember who it was, but like SI, you know, we're in New York, like we sent somebody out there at halftime, like in case they were going to actually pull off the, would have been like the most enormous upset in college football history. Miami ended up running away with it in the fourth quarter, but they were actually winning that game at halftime. In non-Big Ten news, really awful news, Jaylen Waddle, who I believe was the most exciting player in college football, at least since last season, maybe even since his freshman season, is out for the season, broke his ankle on the first on the kickoff, on the first play of the game. And it was interesting to hear Nick Saban afterward say flat out, like, what a sad day this was for him, how sad he was for Jaylen Waddle and his family, and also how sad he was for college football fans that they wouldn't get to see him again. I mean, I think we all assume he'll be off to the NFL next year. So, man, what was your thoughts when that happened?
You know, my mind went back to the Tua injury, how it happened, where it goes and all of a sudden, in this case, you're seeing him. I happened to look up at the screen and saw shots of an ambulance, him being loaded into an ambulance. Now, that's how he was leaving the stadium yesterday. And, you know, your heart sinks for them, just and no other than just any other athlete that gets hurt and it looks that serious. But, you know, you start, you know, you're wrapping your mind around the context of as you said, this is an All-American player, a great return man, a great receiver. Now, Alabama, you know, we kind of have marveled at what they did in the first month of the SEC season, where you lose two first-round picks at receivers, and they seem to – they don't miss a beat. I don't want to say they got better, but, like, you know, you had Waddle, you had Devontae Smith, and then John Mechie, he starts to emerge as a breakout player this year. And so, you know, look, I still think Alabama's clearly a clear number one team in the SEC. And again, they still have Devontae Smith. They still have Mechie. I imagine Slade Bolden will try, you know, somewhat fill some of the role. I can't say he's going to step in his shoes just because they're different players. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they go from there. I just don't know who really challenges them in, you know, is Georgia still the team that has the best chance to hang with them? I mean, because it certainly is not going to make their offense any better or their special teams gate be better to not have him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the crazy thing is that even after taking away one of the best players in college football, that offense probably will not miss a beat in the short term. I think, you know, you probably won't even necessarily notice it until they get into the postseason. And when you're playing a Clemson or an Ohio State that can put up a whole bunch of points, you'd sure love to have that guy who was a possible touchdown anytime he touched the ball. But I mean, they're already so loaded. And in particular, this doesn't get said enough about Alabama this year. Their offensive line is so dominant that it's almost like, I mean, Mac Jones, he never gets pressured, it seems like. He just stands back there and waits for somebody to get open and throws to them. Or he hands it to Najee Harris and he goes for a big gain. So I don't know that it's like a devastating from a competitive standpoint. It's just devastating to not, you know, anytime you see a player of that caliber, his season, in this case, probably his college career, abruptly ends. Elsewhere in the SEC, I feel like every game of LSU's season so far has been a roller coaster. Are you ready to jump back on the bandwagon now after what they did in South Carolina?
No, it's too early. I mean, this is South Carolina. I was really impressed by TJ Finley. I watched a bunch of that game, and he was not a big recruit. Now, physically, he's a huge dude, and I know he has a big arm, but he played with a ton of confidence, and he showed a lot of poise, and really looked in command. I mean, this was a guy who was 6'6", 260, or 6'5", 260 when he showed up, and now he's about 245, I guess. But the ball jumps out of his hand, and just the confidence that they seem to have had in him. The one thing that I think does bode well for LSU and what has been obviously a very turbulent first month of the season for them is probably the three of the biggest stars they had yesterday, certainly Finley, B.J. Ojulari, who had three sacks, and Elias Ricks, their cornerback, who's opposite Derek Stingley, didn't have a pass completed against them and had a pick six. And so probably their three big stars were all three true freshmen. I mean, that's something you usually don't see on a Saturday night in SEC football. So they still got to get a lot better on defense. I mean, they did show some signs last night, but they still gave up a bunch of, you know, big plays, a couple of long runs, a couple of big plays to the tight end. You know, it'll be interesting to see how they do against an Auburn team that, you know, we love Seth Williams, and they seem to have pretty good skill talent for Bo Nix, but I don't know. I mean, how good do you really think Auburn is at this point?
Well, I had pretty much written them off 2 weeks ago. Like, they should have lost to Arkansas. So but you never know with a Gus Malzahn team that his best teams have gotten a lot better over the course of the season. I do think Tank Bigsby is going to be a star. I mean, he kind of already is. He's already run for three straight 100-yard games. And Seth Williams doesn't get nearly enough respect as one of the best receivers in college football. So like you said, though, it'll come down to how Bo Nix plays over the rest of the season. But that was a nice win for them against Ole Miss. All right, Bruce, what do you say we get to the emails?
Let's do it.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com.
Okay, Stu, this question from Quinn in Bowling Green, Ohio. Stu and Bruce, as your hometown Cincinnati Bearcats finish up through their thorough victory against ranked SMU, how legitimate of a challenger do you think they become to Oklahoma State and a potential Pac-12 champ in the playoff race? What are the odds that the state of Ohio compromises half of this year's college football playoff. By the way, Cole also adds his alma mater, the Falcons. I doubt
he's from.
I doubt we'll do anything substantial in the renewed MAC season. Feel free to move this to your mailbag column on The Athletic if you'd rather. Stu, let's scoop this up and keep it on the Audible.
I thought that that was one of the most impressive wins anybody had on Saturday. SMU, even I know they've lost a couple of their key guys to injury, but they still that offense under Sonny Dykes can be a very explosive offense. But Luke Fickell's defense held them to 13 points. Desmond Ridder, the quarterback, who I think has been the big hesitation for Cincinnati fans, like, can we do this with him as the quarterback, had a great game. I think I gave you a little bit of crap for having them so high in the top 10 last week. They legitimized themselves for sure with that performance. Can they make the playoff? I mean, to this point, the committee has not taken the AAC very seriously. They usually have their best team a few spots, if not more, behind where the AP has them. And they don't have the benefit this year of, you know, a showcase Power 5 win. Their non-conference win, though, was Army, who on Saturday became the first team in the country to get bowl eligible, although technically they were not using
that. Isn't everybody bowl eligible?
Yes. What I meant to say is they became the first team to officially accept an invitation to a bowl game. I guess the Independence Bowl still wanted to see six wins before they signed them on the dotted line. I feel like
everybody outside of UConn is bowl eligible at this point.
Yeah, true. I think that I still have my doubts that the committee is going to take the Pac-12 champ seriously. Seven games is not a lot of games. He brought up Oklahoma State, who had a really good win against Iowa State, who seems to have a legit defense for the first time that I can remember. I think any Power 5 champ is still going to – they're still going to default to them over the AAC champ. But I don't know that I have faith in Oklahoma State or anybody else to get through the Big 12 with only one loss. I don't think any of those teams are particularly dominant. So if they suddenly become less attractive, if you take the Pac-12 off the map, well, now, yeah. I mean, your options are starting to narrow. But I think I'm going to be of the position that – and this is not specific to Cincinnati – that I'm going to believe it when I see it, that they would actually put a group of five team in the playoff. But I also think that Cincinnati is better than a whole lot of Power 5 teams. So it's almost unfair to brand them that way.
Let me ask you a question, because I'm obviously with you on Cincinnati, even in a bigger way, I guess. But if I said to you Cincinnati this year could be put in the Big Ten West, what percent chance would you have them to win the Big Ten West?
They have a... they have kind of a Big Ten West feel to them, don't they? Blue-collar defensive team.
They feel like sometimes like a Michigan State team, which is obviously there's roots there.
My only hesitation is that we used to go through this when Utah was still in the Mountain West and when they would go undefeated, or Boise State or TCU when they were a group of five. And the doubters would say, well, if they had to play an SEC schedule or Big Ten schedule, they wouldn't be undefeated, you know. And I was always the one to stand up for those teams. But we kind of saw that when Utah joined the Pac-12, when TCU joined the Big 12. They got brought back to earth a little bit because they just didn't have the depth. And so that would be my only hesitation.
But that's not what I'm asking you, Stu. I'm asking you if they would, because I don't think anyone's going to go undefeated in the Big Ten West.
I'm saying in a one-game setting, no, they could beat any of the teams in the
Big
Ten.
That's not what I'm asking you.
You're asking me if they could play a full Big Ten.
Would you make who would you make the favorite in the Big Ten West if Cincinnati is in it?
Yeah, you and I somehow came away from that Wisconsin Illinois game with much different levels of faith in Wisconsin. Wisconsin still would be my pick, even with Cincinnati in the division. But I think they do very well.
Okay.
I mentioned earlier the James Franklin angst. Seth Borley, concerned Penn State fan, how can such a bad game day coach be considered elite?
Okay, I can tell you how he can be considered elite, because whether people want to just gloss over this or not, I'm sorry, maybe with the exception of Nick Saban, nobody else was going to do what James Franklin did at Vanderbilt. I mean, that was as a remarkable a turnaround as any coach has done in the time I've covered college football. And not just that, it's not just a turnaround. After James Franklin left, it went back to being a real dud program. So start with that. And then look, I mean, you can look at James Franklin's only beaten Ohio State once. Who else has beaten Ohio State? Also, in that conference, they had a couple other games where it wasn't like they're getting blown out, where they've taken Ohio State to the wire on that. So, yeah, look, you can nitpick a lot of people's game day management style if you've had enough track record and been there a long enough time. And obviously, there's going to be some situations where you can say, all right, that was definitely the wrong call. But I mean, you know, I don't know. I go back on this and it's like, if I said to you, is Kirby Smart a top five coach? He's obviously recruited that well, and he's got the win-loss record to do it. But certainly we've seen a bunch of game day things from Kirby Smart that would make you go, why did he call that fake at that situation or whatever? Why did he make this decision or whatnot? I just think you have to look at the body of work of what a coach has done. And to me, can you honestly tell me there are five coaches out there you think are better coaches based on what they have done and what their teams have done right now than James Franklin?
It's funny, you're trying to defend him as a top five coach, and I just had a back and forth with a Michigan fan this morning trying to claim he's not even a top 25 coach, or at least that Harbaugh should be ahead of him.
You know, it's one thing when people say that, Stu, and I know you're not making this case, but like, they could say that, but then all of a sudden it's like, who are the other 25 coaches that you're going to say is better?
I'm going to start out defending James Franklin, and then I'm going to play devil's advocate. You mentioned the Vanderbilt thing, which is a remarkable accomplishment. The thing that people have completely forgotten or didn't appreciate at the time, when the Jerry Sandusky scandal happened and they leveled those sanctions on them, we thought Penn State was going to go into the Stone Ages for a decade. I mean, those were crippling sanctions. Now, they did end up basically ending them early. But the point is, he took over a program that was reeling from that had had at least, I think, two smaller recruiting classes. And they won the Big Ten in his third season. I'll never understand why that wasn't more appreciated at the time, and it's certainly been forgotten now. Now, devil's advocate, that was 5 years ago. This is completely his program. This is completely his recruits. And I think that Penn State fans at this point are measuring him against they want to see the program be what it was, peak Joe Paterno. And they're not there yet. And I don't know if they'll get there. I think that when they not only beat Ohio State, but then could have certainly beaten them. I was at that game in 2017 in Columbus with Saquon Barkley. They blew a really big lead and they lost by 1 point to JT Barrett. They lost by 1 point to them again at home the next year. At that moment, that was when Franklin gave the whole monologue, if you will, about how we've become a good program, but we need to become a great program. And they haven't really followed up on it since then, right? I mean, they did go 11-2 last year, but it felt a little bit.
Can I counter this, Stu?
Yes.
You want to talk about peak Joe Paterno, and obviously this is a slippery slope to go down too much Joe Paterno stuff. I get that. But just talk about the record of their success. You got to go back 25 years to find a stretch where Penn State finished in the top 10 three out of a four-year stretch. And remember, they're in the toughest division arguably in college football right now. They're not an independent. They're not in a different kind of Big Ten where it's way more watered down. I mean, it's a meat grinder division right now. So again, I just think you have to look at that in total. And I don't think you're making this case, but like, start counting down the list of coaches you think are more accomplished and have done a better job than James Franklin.
Well, I think that this shows you that, first of all, he's being held to an impossible standard, but also just how much the playoff. I mean, basically, if you want to, everybody measures everybody now about the playoff and whether they've won a national championship. And that being the case, there are two elite coaches in college football and nobody else. Nobody, if that's your standard, then it's Dabo and Nick Saban and everybody else is a chump. Because think about it. We're talking about him, Franklin, being overrated. There are people who think Kirby Smart is overrated.
There are people who are going to say, look at what Lincoln Riley has. He can't.
People think Lincoln Riley's overrated. It's like if you don't win the national championship in your first few years, then you're overrated. I mean, when I do those top 25 coaches lists, there's 25 spots to fill, and you can't fill them all with Saban and Dabo. So I'm not going to like reevaluate it after one, you know, they literally one game into the Big Ten season, but yeah, I'm not jumping off the James Franklin bandwagon, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, if they have a bad season, you know, after, I mean, this is a team that from like last season, I think Penn State fans kind of treated as, you know, free money. Like, this was the year they were pointing toward when Sean Clifford would have another year's experience and all those running backs. And of course, we thought they would have Michael Parsons. Let's not forget they lost one of the best defensive players in the country. So, you know, if they end up having a bad season, if they end up finishing behind Indiana in the Big Ten standings, then yeah, you'll have reason to criticize them. But let's not forget everything before it just yet.
And this is how fickle those rankings are. I think if I had asked you in 2018, is Gary Patterson a top 10 coach? And I don't remember your list, but I'm guessing you would have said probably yes.
Absolutely.
Gary Patterson, since 2018, you know what his record is combined now?
It can't be good.
6-10. It's 6 and 10, by the way, in a really mediocre Power 5 conference right now. Now, I think Gary Patterson's a brilliant defensive coach, and I think he's done a great job at TCU. But I think that's just the thing that speaks to you know, kind of the level of scrutiny, I think, when everything gets micro-analyzed like this.
Daryl B. Harsh is a Pitt fan. And for that, I just say my condolences.
You think Daryl B. Harsh is his real name?
Well, it's a very specific spelling of Daryl, D-A-R-Y-L-E. You're thinking he made it up?
No, I'm thinking the B. Harsh is just too. Where's this question going?
2 years ago, I wrote you guys with a similar problem, Pat Narduzzi. Pitt fans entered this season with high hopes. At 3-0, we were flying high. Now at 3-4 with an embarrassing loss to Notre Dame, all hope is gone. We're looking at 3-8 or 4-7 at best. Our issues are not COVID related. What do we do? I think that it's fair to say at this point that it's not going to happen. He's been there 6 years and they just can't string together any momentum or any consistency. I do think they could rebound here and win a few games, but then they play Clemson and he's lost at least 5 games every season so far. And when Clemson will be lost number 5 this year. So I'm not saying they're going to fire him by any means, but I don't think he's, you know, suddenly in year 6 or year 7 going to lead Pitt to glory.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they haven't had Kenny Pickett the last couple of weeks, but just as you said, I mean, it wasn't just like they lost 17-7. I mean, they got smoked by a team that really struggled in the offense to hit any big plays the week before against Louisville. And I don't know. It definitely feels like both Pitt, Virginia Tech, there's a bunch of teams in the ACC where you start to feel like optimistic about them, and then all of a sudden they just completely lay an egg. And this was a lot more than that. And like Daryl said, it has just been disappointing. And I don't know what much more to say about that. I mean, I think Pitt's a good job. And Pitt has amazing football history. If you look at the people who've come from there, it's obviously has a pretty strong recruiting area around it. There's a lot of, you know, has really good facilities. And I don't know. I mean, I thought they would have been a lot better this year.
You know who would be a perfect coach for that job?
They want
Matt
that.
Campbell.
Matt Campbell. Matt Campbell started his playing career at Pitt.
Matt Campbell would be
okay.
Would be about as he just screams Pitt to me.
Matt Campbell, though,
his whole
wants to be at Iowa State. Does he want to go up against Clemson? And is Pitt that? Does he look at Pitt? By the way, like I said, that's where he started playing his college football career. Does he look at Pitt as like a destination job? Where like if I leave Iowa State, I'm not going to make another move.
You know, is it a destination job? No. Yeah, I don't know. Look, Pat Narduzzi's contract goes through 2024. In this time of financial constraints, I don't think they're really in a position to run him off. But like you said, I mean, if it was possible in this fantasy world where maybe Matt Campbell, maybe there's an opening next year, it's what you said before. He would have just better recruiting territory. It's really hard to recruit at Iowa State. But there's players that you can get at Pitt. And all you got to do is look at the Aaron Donalds and just show the list of players that have come through there. You know, LeSean McCoy. Like they've had, that's the thing about Pitt football. They've had some really elite players over the last however many years, but they've never been able to field an elite team or even close to an elite team. So I think that's why you sense, you know, the frustration that Darryl B. Harsh here is expressing. Last one, Bruce. One of my favorite moments of Saturday involved our friend Tim Brando. And BP, you all should have Brando on this week. Aside from him being awesome, ask him about his broadcast on Iowa State, Oklahoma State. They lost power or something, and it was just dead air for a while. Bruce, I happened to be watching the game when this happened. It was the rare time, probably the only time in Tim's career where he was silenced. Something went wrong with the broadcast, but we could still hear him. He thought we couldn't hear him, but we could hear him saying, "We've lost power. We've lost the whole thing." And then I don't know if they then pulled the plug on him or he just assumed he just stopped talking, but they then ran three or four plays with no broadcasters. And then I forget which team had the ball at that point, but whoever it was punted and they went to commercial. And then when they came back, it had been fixed. But we lost Tim and Spencer for about a series there.
There was, when I heard this, I actually didn't hear it live. I had the game on, but we had sound on, I think it was Michigan State, Indiana at the same time. But Max Olson's texting me like I had heard it and I didn't. And I just had visions of Tim had a moment years, and he can laugh at this. I mean, I was with him, but not for this particular game. It was involved a Texas Tech game. And, where he got a little worked up and he said some things. And I just remember thinking, if an announcer, in this case, our friend Tim, ever gets a little too verbally engaged, like, is there somebody back in the truck who just like bear claws and yanks out some cords to basically say, we got to stop this? And I remember, look, at this point, I think I had done TV 2 years or maybe 2.5 years. And I said to Eric Billigmeier, who was our producer, like, I still remember where I was when I asked him this question. I was like, you mean if something really went haywire or whatever, you couldn't just like rip the cords and we got to shut Tim off. And, you know, obviously that's not what happened yesterday, but it was, it's kind of fitting that it happened to Tim. Tim, we love you, but just like, as you said, nothing stops Tim from talking. And this to have it, and, you know, look, I'm glad for Tim's own sake that that's the worst thing that was said over the air, as opposed to, I think he's obviously experienced enough to know that if he says some four letter word in frustration or something like that, he knows it probably could get picked up or whatever. And so
it seemed we saw with the Joe Buck, Troy Aikman thing, pretty much anything can get out there now. So, you know, if I were had a mic on me, whether I thought it was on or not, I would be very careful what I say. I half expected, like, I didn't know how long it was going to be out. I half expected for him to start showing up in my Twitter feed doing the play-by-play, not letting it go silent for too long. Anyway, it was a fun Saturday. I mean, I figured it would be with the Big Ten coming back, but it just, it was really like the 3:30 Eastern window was the first time all season where there were too many games going on to keep up. There were too many games that I wanted to see to possibly watch. So that was fun. And it's only going to get better from here. We're only 2 weeks away from full capacity Pac-12, Pac-12 and MAC. So, we should do shout outs.
Why don't you go first? Because it sounds like you have one teed up already to go.
It's funny because it's almost always you. You're almost always the one that is like, let's do shout outs. And I'm like, I didn't think to prepare one for that. But sounds like this week we are in opposite. So you mentioned, I think I heard you make a passing reference to getting your hopes up for Virginia Tech, only to have them lose to Wake Forest. Well, The key player in the Wake Forest-Virginia Tech game was Wake Forest safety Nick Anderson, who had three interceptions. That's not something you see very often for a player to have three interceptions, including one that sealed the game. Well, Nick Anderson is a walk-on freshman, a recruited walk-on, but a walk-on nonetheless, who earned a starting job within his first couple games. And then obviously, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we see him win some of these, you know, National Defensive Player of the Week awards that they put out. So shout out to Nick.
By the way, I think last week Arkansas had a player who had three picks in a game.
Fair enough. Still pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to stop you from that. Okay, my shout out, and he was mentioned earlier in the podcast, is to Noah Vedral. As we said, Nick Starkel, I think you and I talked about this offline, was a guy who played at two SEC schools and then last night played for San Jose State.
Got his first Mountain West victory.
And Noah Vedral, you know, from UCF to Nebraska to getting a start in the Big Ten. And shout out to him because he played really well. And I think for those guys who have bounced around and are looking for opportunities, obviously Starkel had played and started at A&M and started at Arkansas. But, you know, between being behind Mackenzie Milton and then being behind Adrian Martinez, and now he goes to a place and he beats out a guy in Arthur Sitkowski who came in there with a big reputation and has a lot of talent. I think that's a credit to him to being so persistent. And so shout out to him and the Scarlet Knights for a very, very impressive debut.
Very good. A lot of Rutgers love on this podcast this week. Love seeing it. And we'll see you next time. Yeah.